I would rather die on my feet than live on my knees. They were fighting for the right to live autonomously.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guest for today is a business leader, an activist, a social media influencer, and the star of her own Netflix show, who has two seasons, My Unorthodox Life. So here I am with Julia Hart.
I am very honored to be here. I think you're a warrior for the Jewish people, and I wish there were more Shais around.
Thank you. Really. Thank you so much. And I apologize for you being stuck in traffic getting
okay.
here.
You it was know, worth it.
I, you know, we can do these things. Sometimes we do it virtually, but there's nothing like being
nothing
in
like
person
face
and
to
meeting.
Face.
We've meeting for the first time.
I know.
So I thanked you off camera, but I want to thank you on camera.
Well,
you've been instrumental in amplifying mine and other voices to audiences that we may not have reached. So thank you.
Well, I have to say that, you know, warriors come in. They don't have to always wear army fatigues, and you are a warrior.
Thank you.
I'm very grateful to you, truly.
But thank you so much. But we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about you.
All right.
And I'm going to start the episode like I start every episode by asking you, Julia, what kind of a Jew are you?
I'm a very proud and loud one.
All right. Have you always been a proud and loud Jew?
You know, where I lived before, you couldn't really be loud. So I guess I've been very loud about my Judaism and how much I love being a Jew from the moment that October 7th happened. I didn't feel the need prior to that to, you know, my Jewishness was just an inherent part of me. But once someone messed with my family, that's when I became loud.
And we're going to get to that. and I want to talk about, you said, I wasn't allowed or able to be loud where I came from. And I want to talk about where you came from. But to set the stage, because this is, you know, some people are watching this on YouTube. Some people are listening on Spotify and Apple Podcast. I think we're missing something. But I love every person that engages with the podcast. But just to set the stage, tell the people that are not watching, what are you wearing from top to bottom? And since you have your own talent agency, I think you'll be really good at doing this. So,
well, I'm wearing a Balmain suit with shorts and custom boots that I designed.
And I would say it's like it's a strong pink.
Say I would
suit.
Say like a salmon.
Big hoop.
Huge hoop earrings, very 70s.
You have some Israeli.
Oh well, my
or
jewelry.
Jewish...
I'm not a giant jewelry person. The only jewelry I have is chutzpah, and the state of Israel.
And the reason why I want people to have an image is because you didn't always dress
not.
Like this.
Long sleeves to lingerie, baby.
So tell me, where are you from? Where did you grow up? Where weren't you allowed to be loud?
Well, I grew up in a very extremist version of ultra-Orthodox Judaism, where women are told that their purpose in life is to be silent, subservient, obedient, wives and mothers. And, you know, to be a good woman, you have to disappear. Basically, you can only achieve greatness by proxy. You can't become the scholar. You can't become the great rabbi. You can't become the leader. You have to be the person eliminating all stress from your great master, your husband, so that he can be the leader, right? So, to be a good person, that's what you have to be. If you attract male attention or you're noticeable or you're in any way, shape, or form out of the mold, you're a bad woman, right? You're a yatzanit. You're someone who flits around. And in the Torah, there's this woman, Dina, she went out of her tent and it ended up destroying, making a giant war and killing all these people in this place called Shechem. So the message was very loud and clear. Women who leave their homes and are outgoing cause war.
And so, you were born into this community.
No, I was not.
Oh, you were not born.
No, so, got to read my book.
Well, I don't have the chronology exactly right.
Yeah.
So you were married into this.
So I was born in Moscow. My parents and I were traded for grain through the Jackson-Vanik Bill. I came here over 10 years before Perestroika and Gorbachev. I came here when it was still Brezhnev. And there was a...
Where did you come to?
Well, that's actually a funny... It's a complicated situation because when we left Russia, it was the first wave of, you know, refusing... My father was in prison because he was a massive anti-communist and they caught him observing Shabbos, and so he went to jail. So both my parents are scientists. They both worked on the first PC computer for IBM. So basically America got us and Russia got some grain. And so, but before we got here, I left when I was 3. I didn't make it here until I was 5 because they really didn't know what to do with us. It was such a new concept. So I lived for 6 months in an internment camp in Vienna. And then I lived for 9 months in the Vatican, in an internment camp in the Vatican.
Who was running these internment camps?
Hias. It was a Hebrew something organization that was organizing all of this. And then finally from the Vatican, we were adopted by the Jewish community of Austin, Texas. So basically the way it worked is a city had to adopt you and take responsibility for your welfare and your support. And the city of Austin, Texas adopted my family.
Did you come in as a community or just your family?
My parents and myself. I was
dropped
the first
from
Russian kid in the entire state of Texas. And
Is that
yeah,
a fact?
That's an actual fact. I was the first Russian kid because people weren't coming out of Russia. I came here in 1975.
Okay.
So it's years before Russians started coming to the States. And so, you know, I come to this colorful, fabulous, I mean, I love Austin. I have amazing memories. And while we were living in Austin, and those are the only years of my life that I had a little sense of normalcy, so there was, at the time, Texas was still segregated. And the federal government instituted this program called busing, where they bus black kids into white schools and white kids into black schools to create, you know, unity and integration. And so from what I've been told, Texas in quasi-revolt decided, okay, well, if we can't segregate people by color, we're going to do it by test score. And their thought was, like, because the white students had such a better education and were given so many more opportunities, that they would score better on this test, and so they could segregate that way. A, it failed completely. Black kids did incredibly well, and it didn't work. Mm. And I got the highest mark in the state of Texas. So that put me in front of, you know, some very important people who convinced this school called Kirby Hall to take me as a student. I was the first Jew in Kirby Hall. There was one Jew and one black. I was the token Jew. And, I mean, I loved it. You know, we learned logarithms in fourth grade. You know, I mean, it was unbelievable. I was learned how to speed read. I mean, it was an incredible place. And so those are my only moments of what I would call normalcy. And then when I was 9, my parents became extremely ultra-Orthodox. They were brought through that direction through the Lubavitch community that was in Austin. And then they decided that Austin wasn't religious enough and Lubavitch wasn't religious enough. So they moved us to Muncie, where the gates of the modern world shut until I was 42 years old and walked out.
Before we get to the walking out, let's talk about the walking in. What was it like for a 9-year-old, clearly very, very bright kid who has such a glorious future ahead of her? What was it like, just not just moving states, not just changing schools, but changing an entire life?
It was awful. I mean, you know, I went from learning incredible, you know, mathematics and science and creating all these amazing experiments. I mean, we built rockets. We did really great stuff to 5+7, to schools that thought that the only thing that women need to be educated in is basic arithmetic because they're the ones that are going to be interfacing with the outside world. And a smattering of English. Most of my teachers were not exactly adept at the English language. You know, I had a biology teacher. We learned.
So did you speak Yiddish?
No, I spoke Yinglish and Hebrew. I'm not Hasidic. I grew up in a black hat community, so yeah. Different payas, same rules, right? But it's the only people who spoke Yiddish were the boys. The boys learned in Yiddish and in Aramaic because the Talmud is written in Aramaic. Of course, women were not taught Aramaic because we weren't allowed to read the Talmud. I had an entire library of bookshelves that I wasn't allowed to read.
How much interaction did you have, like you said, with the outside world?
None.
You said the gates were locked.
Zero. None. No television, no radio, no newspapers. I knew nothing about the outside world. Literally nothing.
Then you got married.
Got married.
At 18?
19.
19.
I went on a hunger strike. My mother was just like, it's fine, you'll look better in your dress. No big deal.
Okay, wait. So, you know, for you, it's like an obvious thing, but tell me what.
Well, because
that?
I didn't want to marry him. And he was, so the way that it works in my world is you go on basically 3 to 5 dates. They have a very specific guideline. You have to be in a public place. You can't be alone. And they can't last more than an hour and a half. And then you give time for travel back and forth. So basically, I knew my husband for maybe 9 hours before we got married. And I had already said no to 2 men, which was already like, so my mother literally said on guy 3, the guy I end up marrying, she's like, if he's not a mass murderer, you're marrying him. Like, that's it. We're not doing this nonsense. You already said no to 2 guys. You have to commit. So yeah, that's what happened at 19. I married someone I didn't, you know, he's a very nice person. He's a good man. We co-parent beautifully, but he wasn't someone I liked or admired. And hence, thus my life began. And you know, he was even more religious than my parents. So like my first Shabbat, I'm a newlywed, I'm a teenager. My head is covered, I'm covered head to toe. And literally, I think we moved into my apartment on Wednesday.
When you say I'm covered head to toe, and the reason why I want to focus on that, because you
I'm vastly uncovered.
Fashion, you're a fashion mogul. Right, like you control from the modeling to the creating of the fashion. So, what does it mean, covered head to toe? What was it?
Well, to me, and you see this in every fundamentalist community. It doesn't matter if it's Mormons or Mennonites or Muslims or Jews. The minute you get extremist, women get covered, and the idea is that men are incapable of controlling themselves, and so a man's sin is a woman's responsibility. So she has to disappear herself so that man won't sin. And I just find this so fascinating, A, because obviously it's ludicrous, but secondly, we're supposed to be the weaker sex, and yet we're so dangerous, and men are so terrified of us that we have to literally disappear so that they can live a calm life.
So you're covered head to toe.
So basically the way that it works is you have to be covered, everything has to be below your elbows, above your collarbone, 4 inches below your knee, and a few inches above your ankle. So the only parts, and then you have to wear tights. And in my community, I wore tights and then socks on top of them just in case if the tight would tear and someone would see a little bit of skin. So I had to double cover my legs. So my entire life, the only parts of my body that were uncovered were my face and my hands. So to me, I will always wear the shortest shorts I can find and the lowest cut tops because that's freedom. Freedom is choosing what you get to put on your body.
And then your first Shabbat.
Oh yeah, my first Shabbat. Off. So he invites a bunch of his friends from yeshiva. And I've obviously never made Shabbat on my own. And I'm literally married for 2 minutes. And I'm, you know, petrified. And I'm also teaching in two schools. I was teaching in 2 high schools. And if you know, in wintertime, the sun sets very early. So I'm teaching till 1 o'clock. And when light, when it's, you know, when it's, what's it called? When the sunset, shit, excuse me. When it's sunset, you can't operate anything. You can't turn on an oven. You can't turn on a light, the 3 stars. So basically I had 2 hours to make Shabbos. And of course, nobody was going to help me, right? It was going to be just me. So I scramble and I work so hard. My challenge came out blue, but that's okay. But I managed to pull it together, and eight guys come, and I literally, I mean, it was crazy because, you know, I'm doing lesson plans. I'm teaching in two high schools. I'm doing the food shopping. I'm doing the cooking. I'm doing the cleaning. I'm doing the setting of the table and the serving. And the meal ends and everyone was very happy and they left, and I just felt so good. And I turn around thinking my husband's going to be so happy with me. And he was so upset, so angry with me because I spoke at the meal. I was supposed to sit there silently for hours because speaking at the meal was an embarrassment to him. He's like, I'm going to have to go in yeshiva and people are going to be talking about the fact that you spoke.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And you stayed for 23 years.
Yeah.
Through time, did you speak more and more?
Oh, yeah. By the time I walked out the door, I was basically gone already. Like, you know, when I decided that I wanted to leave in my 30s, I started watching television. I started reading secular literature. You're a college professor. I literally read everything I could get my hands on. Spinoza, Descartes. I mean, you name it. I've literally read it. I have, my son graduated Columbia. My daughter graduated Stanford. And I would make them send me their reading lists every semester. And in 4 years of university, they had not sent me a book I hadn't already read. So I really became a voracious reader. Because I knew nothing about the outside world. I had to educate myself. And I had to find a way to make money because I wasn't leaving without my kids. So it was a very gradual process. By the time I left, I was openly going to movies. I was basically, you know, out.
Came out, started living your life. But then you also took on the role of activist, mostly for women's rights. And I've, by the way, I've seen you, there's footage of you helping in Ukraine, helping refugees in Ukraine from the war.
I actually went to Bakhmut. I was in the front lines. I drove.
What brought you there?
So most people in America take freedom for granted. I remember when I first left and I walked into the 21st century and I found out that you can read anything. You could, you know, access all of this knowledge. And I was so shocked that there was so many people who didn't utilize this gift of educating themselves and, you know, creating an elastic mind where they're eternal students. I just couldn't comprehend it. And then I realized that you can take freedom for granted. I don't take freedom for granted. And when I saw what was happening in Ukraine, they weren't fighting for land. They weren't fighting for power or money. They were fighting for the right to live autonomously. And you know Emiliano Zapata? He was a Spanish freedom fighter. And he once said, I would rather die on my feet than live on my knees. And that's why I went to Ukraine. Because to me, they were fighting for freedom. And I think that, you know, I know this is going to sound really weird, but like I have these two images of how I die. One is at like 120 with a pen in my hand designing something. The other is like a Viking, sword in hand, fighting for something I believe in. So, you know, I really felt very connected to the Ukrainian people. I bought an ambulance with a bunch of other people. We bought 7 ambulances. Of course, I bought them from the UK. I didn't think to myself,
how do we get them?
No, just... the steering wheel on the wrong side. Try driving a car with the steering wheel on the wrong side through a war-torn country. Not so fun. So anyway, we drove from Slovakia to Bakhmut, to the front lines in Ukraine in January of 2023, when that's where the heaviest fighting was. There was no power, there was no cell service, and we stuffed these ambulances with literally everything you could think of, IFAX kits, and tourniquets, clothing, gloves, scarves, literally anything we could think of, devices that could be used in the front lines to communicate with specialists all around the world. Really amazing stuff. And I, you know, I stayed there in Ukraine for 3 weeks or four, I can't recall, 3 or 4 weeks. And then I went back in June and we opened the first women's shelter for women who had been, you know, sexually trafficked by Russians. And I walked an active landmine to bring awareness to the fact that when Russians leave, they tend to leave landmines in kindergartens, in children's playgrounds, in farms. And if you know that Ukraine feeds half of Africa and a large swath of Europe, you realize what a very serious situation that creates. So I went to Ukraine twice in 2023, and then I started the year in a war zone, and I ended the year in a war zone because in December of 2023, I went with an active army unit into Gaza.
And I want to get into that. But I want to talk about your activism for women first.
Yeah.
We're going to get to October 7th. Unfortunately, we have
to.
Yeah,
we have to.
It's a cloud that always is above each and every one of us. But tell me about your women's rights activism.
So when I
just to set the stage for everyone.
So when I first left, my only goal was freedom for myself and my children. I wanted them to have every opportunity. I wanted them to choose what they wanted to be in life. And that was my sole focus.
You took your kids with
you when
you
left.
Was that an issue? Was that a problem?
Well, it's almost unheard of. People like me who leave, their kids stay behind. So I am incredibly blessed that I managed to bring my kids along.
How did you do that, if I may ask?
Oh, no convincing. Inviting. I would say, hey, do you want to come to Paris with me? Hey, do you want to go to Greece? And I just showed them the world. I knew if I'd argued with them or tried to make them irreligious, it would never have worked. And they all went on a very different path. Batsheva and Shlomo kept Shabbos until 2020 or 2021. So I never pushed. I never demanded. I just said, here's the world, and I want you to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And so when I first came out, that was my goal. And then I realized that there are tens of millions of women like me. They may not be coming from my community, but I mean, obviously extremist fundamentalist Islam is 1,000 times worse. You know, in my community, if you don't follow the rules, they'll kick you out of school. You won't get a good match for your children. In Afghanistan, they're going to chop your head off, right? So I don't want to compare the two. However, in those kind of communities, like my television show was number one in Lebanon because it's all the same experience. And I realized that if I don't use what happened to me to do something good, then it was stolen years. And so I promised myself that I would find a purpose in my life. And my purpose was to create an army of as many financially independent women as I humanly could. And
Wait, let me, army of financially independent women.
Yes.
Why that? You could get an army of activists, women and men. You could get an army of feminists.
Because
why
if you have to ask permission, you're not free. And so many women still till this day believe that they need someone to support them or take care of them. And I wanted every woman to know that if this literally nobody from nowhere in 11 years could build a $1 billion business, anything is possible. When my kids were younger, they loved going to the zoo, and I really hated the zoo. I didn't like the idea of anything caged. It gives me full-on anxiety. But they kept on nudging and nudging, and I found this zoo in San Diego where it's basically open. They like recreate all these animals' habitats. So I'm with the kids in this like Range Rover-y kind of situation, and there's a tour guide, and he's taking us through all of these different, you know, quote-unquote countries and the different animals that exist there. So we get to this place, and there's this African elk that is the highest jumper in the animal kingdom. It can jump higher heights than any other animal in the animal kingdom. And the tour guide says, where's their enclosure? Take a look and show me the enclosure. Where's the gate? These are the animals that can jump as high as possible. Where's their enclosure? We look around, no enclosure. And we all give up. And he points out that at the corners of this, you know, recreation of Africa, were these four telephone poles, very, very tall telephone poles. And connecting these four telephone poles was a half pipe, like a C, a very, very long C. Mm-hmm. So the animals, before they jump, to gauge their distance, they look up and calculate how high the jump is when they come to the edge of the enclosure. These animals, when they looked up, saw this C structure and thought that there was a ceiling. And they never jump. They could walk through and they never jump. And that's what I realized is women. The ceilings we create, so many of them are our own minds. And we can just walk through.
Well, there's something really interesting in what you said, because in Jewish communities, especially for Shabbat, you have this idea called Iruv, which is literally like a string, a piece of string, a tiny piece of string that says at this area you're allowed to be doing Shabbat. And Manhattan is famously the biggest Iruv in the world.
But not my community doesn't hold with that Iruv.
Right. Right. So it's interesting that, you know, and that is, it is a mental restriction.
You accept
that these are my boundaries.
But much more than the string, you know, the genius of fundamentalist religions is they brainwash you into policing yourself, right? You feel guilty when you don't do the right thing. And when you accept something as a given, a complete fabrication, you are literally creating these gates and these fences and these prison walls around yourself that are completely in your mind.
And then October 7th happens.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I did this really from Ukraine. I went to Rwanda, and I walked from remote village to remote village, handing out menstrual cups to women, because when they menstruate, many of them are literally put in sheds. They miss school, they miss work. There's no maxi pads. There's none of that. Right. And you know, a menstrual cup is something that can be reused over and over again for like 10 years. And so I literally walked from village to village teaching about sexual health and wellness and, you know, and what really amazed me, I mean, these are minute, tiny little villages where, you know, there's nothing. I mean, it's, you know, there's no televisions. There's really, it's not exactly modern life. And when I would bring these menstrual cups, and it happened in every single village, you know what the first question I got was? Can we sell this for you? Can we market this? They were so business oriented. They were so driven to better their lives and better their families. And that's what I want for women. I want women to know that they can be the arbiters of their own destiny.
I don't understand why that's a hard sell.
But
unfortunately in our society, it still is.
Yeah.
Not just to women, but mostly to the men that don't allow the financial independence. What happened on October 7th?
There's a brave, heroic operation.
So, you know, I mean, I think the heinous, evil, monstrous acts of just unimaginable bestiality and cruelty that was perpetrated on the Jewish people, that in and of itself is almost impossible to comprehend and grasp. But what made it so much worse was the glee, the joy, the celebration of the outside world. And, you know, I've been, as you said, a very active feminist, and I belong to all of these feminist groups, and they betrayed us. They betrayed us.
How did the feminist groups treat you before October 7?
Oh, I was, you know, a goddess until...
Why so?
Well, because, you know, I really come from nothing and nowhere, and made my first million 9 months after I walked out the door, was being sold all over the world a year and a half later, became creative director of La Perla 2 years after I walked out of Muncie, and then took a $70 million modeling agency and turned it into a billion-dollar media conglomerate. So I was, you know, a good talking point. I was a good example of what women can accomplish if they set their minds to it.
And what happened on October 7th?
And then October 7th, all of these...
Nothing in you changed.
Well, nothing in me changed. However, and you know, hate is always so shocking to me. the fact that when it comes to Jews, all the rules of normalcy, decency, don't apply. The same women who, you know, were with me, you know, when the Iranian women revolted in Iran, they had a huge Washington, you know, parade, whatever.
Woman peace life.
Yeah.
Woman freedom.
I was their keynote speaker. This little Jew girl from Muncie spoke on behalf of the Iranian women. I became very, very involved in the community because to me, I don't care Muslim, Christian, Jewish. I want every woman to have autonomy and to get to choose their own life. And I thought everyone felt the same. And, you know, boy, was I wrong. It's interesting that the Iranian women that I helped and got involved with, they are adamantly pro-Jewish, adamantly pro-Israel. They repost everything I write because we have the same enemy. Fundamentalist Islam does as much damage to them as it does to the Jewish people. And so we should all be getting together and fighting this scourge, right? In my community, I wasn't allowed to sing in public. In Afghanistan, they're not allowed to speak in public. Not much of a difference. Obviously, the punishments are hugely different. Let's make sure we quantify that. But all of these feminist groups, you know, we all say rape is not an act of freedom fighting, except if it's Jews being raped. To have women tell me, oh, I don't think that happened, and to not believe the testimony of women, to ignore the physical, the inordinately large, copious amount of physical evidence that exists, and to justify such acts of just heinous atrocity, it really shook me. I mean, I would never have seen it coming. And sadly, I'm going to own this, my son went to Colombia, and he told me when he started, he's like, Ima, it is insanely anti-Semitic. He's like, every class...
What year was this?
What year are we in? 2024? I think he... this is embarrassing. Okay, I think he graduated in 2021.
Okay. So in the past 7-8 years, yeah.
Yeah. So... And interestingly enough, he had written this op-ed. I don't recall if the New York Times posted it or somebody else did, basically saying how in every one of his classes, he's literally being taught that Israel is bad and that the Palestinians are, the victims and they're the ones who originally lived. Complete and absolute nonsense. And he kept on telling me, I'm telling you, Ima, this is a really... tremendous concern. Every class I go to is inherently anti-Semitic. And I poo-pooed him. I told him, this is America. There's no anti-Semitism in America. It'll be fine. He was right and I was wrong.
And I want to get to your trip to Israel, but before that, what was the role, if any, of Israel in the very closed off community that you lived in for more than 2 decades?
So in my community, Israel's the state of Israel is bad, right? We didn't celebrate Yom HaAtzma'ut or any of those, Yom HaZikaron, none of that. We didn't go to the Israel Day Parade. I started going like a few years before. I was just like, I don't believe any of this stuff. I started going to the Israel Day Parade years before. Because in their
community,
mind...
No, I understand their community, the idea of we cannot have a state, we need the Mashiach to come.
That's correct.
I understand the theological argument for the ultra-Orthodox of non-Zionists. We're not anti-Zionists like Naturei Karta, but we're non-Zionists.
That's correct.
But then why were you attracted or gravitated towards Israel is part of my identity or who I am?
Well, because to me, Judaism isn't about... Being Jewish isn't about religion. Being Jewish is an ethnicity. It's belonging to a community, a country, and Israel is the home to every Jew. And I wanted to define my Judaism not by archaic laws that kept women down, but by the extraordinary accomplishments of the Jewish people that have spread light all over the world I mean, what is it? 66% of Nobel Prize winners are Jews. 64%, something around that.
Something crazy. No, I think something it's lower, crazy. But it's still way, it's way, way disproportionate. It's an absurd number.
Yeah, we're 0.002% of the population. You know, and I've never been prouder to be a Jew than when the world attacked us. To see the, I mean, I spent some time with an IDF unit, and first of all, they're the most gorgeous humans on the planet. Like, I don't know what is in that water. Everyone's hot. It's crazy. Okay, but that, we'll put that to the side for a second, but it is actually amazing. And seriously.
As someone who was in the IDF, I'm not going to correct you. So, you know.
But I mean, I've never seen anything like it, you know, and I loved my time in the Ukrainian army. I loved the camaraderie. Everyone was incredibly upbeat and positive, and they really believed in what they were doing. What I found in the IDF was such a melting pot of humanity. Asians, blacks, Jews, Christians, Druze, Bedouins, I mean, all working in unison. And if people would actually see what the IDF is, I mean, that's how every army should be run. It's an extraordinary experience. I walked out of there and I felt so proud to be a Jew that even at our lowest moments, we think about everyone else. We worry about those who are attacking us. And it's, you know, I have so much respect and appreciation to the state of Israel, to the army, because they protect every Jew in the world. Not to mention that they are, you know, destroying enemies to literal modern society, right? I was at a breakfast with Condoleezza Rice. She spoke at the Paley Center. And some reporter said to her, oh, now that, you know, people are being more positive about Israel, don't you think this is terrible because it's going to prolong the war? And she literally looked at him, like eviscerated this guy. And she said to him, you should be on your hands and knees because they are the only people fighting the most dangerous force to Western and democratic society. Instead of complaining, you should be on your hands and knees thanking them.
Wow. But I still don't understand, and I have to kind of like prod a little bit more.
I have no filter, so go ahead.
this devotion and love to Israel, as state of Israel, but also the idea of Israel, if it's not coming from like your education and your community, which that's not, it's not where it came to you. It came to you, as I understand, in an older age, as an adult.
Yes.
Where is it coming from?
Well, first of all, I love an underdog. I don't like when people mess with those who are trying to do good. It pisses me off. You know, I went to Ukraine. I mean, I'm not Ukrainian, right? But I felt responsible to show up physically and stand with them. And these are my people, right? So if I would do that for Ukraine, how could I not do this for, you know, the people that I'm a part of? And again, I genuinely believe that the way to save Muslim women in these extremist communities is Israel. In the end, they're going to be the ones saving the women in Iran, saving the women in Syria. And I think that Israel is a light to the world. And I'm just massively grateful. And again, you know, I just don't like when people mess with underdogs.
Another interesting thing happened post October 7 in your life, that you said it was the first time in 11 years that you stepped into a synagogue.
Yeah. Ugh, still gives me chills.
What? Tell me about that. Tell me about your experience.
You know, think about in my community what synagogue is, right? The men are in the middle of the action. The women are hidden in some cubby hole behind curtains. The men get the good food. The women don't. I mean, it's just the inequity of it all is just so painful. And, you know, very often I would get called in. I mean, when Hurricane Sandy happened, for example, these pamphlets went all around Muncie blaming women for Hurricane Sandy. It was because we weren't modest enough that God punished everybody with Hurricane Sandy. So that was our fault too. So, you know, I, t- to me, a synagogue is a place of, you know, complete denigration of women. That's how I see it. I'm sure there are synagogues that don't, but my PTSD says I have a very hard time with it.
And yet you stepped into one.
Again, when someone messes with the people I care about, I'm going to do things that are, you know, terrifying to me or uncomfortable, because if they can put their lives on their lines, I can walk into a synagogue.
But let me paint a little bit of a different picture of this. Sure. Because, and again, one of the interesting things is every one of us carries our own baggage.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We cannot carry each other's baggage. We can just encourage each other to keep going. What I saw in the videos that in that event in a synagogue where a Holocaust survivor was speaking,
yes,
and I think you were either introducing her or speaking after or before her, I saw you reclaiming the synagogue. I saw you reclaiming you by saying, I've never been prouder to be a Jew, not a woman, not a, you know, a Philip of Israel, a Jew. Like, you were somehow reclaiming and saying, if I can speak at a synagogue where before I couldn't even show my ankles, something is different.
I mean, I love it. It's fabulous. But, you know, I've been through this metamorphosis about, originally I thought the concepts are beautiful, the practices need some help, right? And then I got into meditation and quantum physics and neuroscience, and I realized that, what do we say about a Jew, right? We say, how do you know a Jewish person? Because they're Rachmanim, Baishanim, Vegomli, Chasadim. Rachmanim means they're people of mercy. And we see that every day, right? These are people who help those who attack them. I mean, it's wild. Gomle Chasadim means people who do acts of charity and kindness. Great. The middle one, Baishanim, means people who feel guilt and shame. You know that in Hebrew, the word we use for fun is kef, right? That's not a biblical word. There is no, in actual Hebrew, like in traditional ancient Hebrew, the word for fun doesn't exist. Because what is fun? Fun is pleasure without purpose. And that's no good. Everything has to have purpose. And we have this very unique concept called Vigilu Bir Ada, which means rejoice with trembling. So if you think of every happy occasion in a Jewish world, you do something to remind yourself of misery.
Right.
And
most famously, during
at the wedding, you break the glass.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. So I realized that, you know, what we have all been taught is that the way to serve God is through guilt and shame and fear and lack. And I just think that's terribly wrong. And I think that I absolutely believe in God. I don't like the word God because it conjures a picture of a dude with, you know, a gray beard. Basically, the way we look at God is this really mean, angry teenager with superpowers. You know, if we don't pay him attention, he messes with us. I mean, if a person would do those things, he'd be in jail. We'd go to the police and we'd say, hey, he's stalking me. I broke up with him and he's not leaving me alone, right? But this is it's bizarre. That's our definition of God. It's nonsense. What if God is this global energy that has everyone and everything in it, and it's just pure, unadulterated love? What if the way to reach God is not through guilt and fear and shame, but through joy and happiness and pleasure? So even a synagogue that is not like mine, I have great difficulty with it because it espouses these kind of ideas. And, you know, now there's just so much data and science of how detrimental guilt and fear is to your body, to your mental health, to your psyche. And it's taking me, I mean, I've done a lot of difficult things in my life. Unlearning everything I had been taught and learning how to not feel fear, to not feel shame, is literally, indubitably the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. Yeah. I'm a work in progress.
We all are. And if someone says that they are perfect, then you can only know that they are perfectly incompetent of introspection.
Exactly.
I do want to push you on one thing.
Go ahead.
If I may.
Push away.
There, you know, this podcast is a podcast for Jewish civil rights. And we immediately put your name on the list of people we would ideally want to have on the show for me, for two reasons. One, because you've been so vocal about Israel, anti-Semitism, and the hostages. Two, because you are fighting for the civil rights of women everywhere, but also Jewish women that mm-hmm. are in very, very restrictive communities.
Yes.
Some may say, and not some may say, I've seen this written,
yeah.
that you're fighting religion, you're fighting Judaism, and you cannot protect Jewish life and at the same time tear down Judaism.
Great question.
What's your reaction to
so
that?
here's the beauty of this. So first of all, I didn't just get accused of that. You're being very polite. I got accused of being an anti-Semite. You want to hear something so wild? So I was doing this event for, you know, because they repealed Roe versus Wade. I've been in a world where your body's not your own. I'm not okay with that being here in the 21st century. So I became very, very politically active when that happened. And I have 100 people at my house. I've got the governor, you know, potential governor of Texas, and, you know, a lot of officials from New York City. It's a really big crowd. And this woman comes over to me and she says, you know, you changed my life. And usually when people say that, they talk about leaving abusive relationships, leaving, you know, restrictive communities, starting businesses, all sorts of things. So that's what I expected. She tells me that after watching my show, she converted to Judaism. Because the Judaism I showed on the show was so beautiful to her that she actually converted. And then recently, I was filming with recently I was filming with something, and this beautiful black woman came over to me and said, I want you to know that you changed my life. And I, again, expected a story about, you know, leaving abusive relationship or starting a business. And she said, after I watched your show, I converted to Judaism. So, A, I think that's pretty much proof positive that my show was not anti-Semitic. And B, here's the part that really gives me hope. I was at a political event. It was when the governor was being elected. And, you know, there was this very, very famous Hasidic person who was there as well. You know, the Hasidim take care to be involved in government. He's super famous. I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to get him into trouble. Super, super famous, renowned. There's no one in my world that doesn't know him. And he travels with an entourage, right? He has all his shamashim, yeah? And I'm standing there and I see him walking towards me. And I'm like, oh boy, here we go. I'm evil. I'm a this, I'm a that. I'm standing my ground, but I'm preparing myself for an attack. And he walks over to me and in front of all of his people.
He recognizes me.
He walks over to me and he looks down. He's a very tall guy. And he says, Ms. Hart, my wife and my daughters thank you. And walked away. So, am I against religion? No. Do I think that the laws that we have in our community are wrong? Absolutely.
When you say our community.
Meaning the extremist version of Orthodox Judaism. Meaning, you want to be a modern Orthodox Jew and women go to college and have, great. I have issue when people tell a woman that she's defined by her biology. And that every woman is put on earth to do the same thing. I have an issue when a woman is told to be silent so that men don't have to worry about sinning. And people can hate me for it. They can disagree with me. Don't really care. I'm going to keep fighting for every woman. And if I tell you, I've collected over 700,000 messages from women, the silent ones, who say, please don't stop fighting for us. Please help us. My son is in a yeshiva in Israel, my youngest one. He's the only religious one. And I was in Jerusalem, and I was in a pizza store, a kosher one, obviously, because I wanted my son to eat with us. And this young girl, you know, covered head to toe with the whole nine yards, she comes over to me, and she hugs me and bursts out crying. And she said, every one of my friends watched your show. Help us leave. Help us. So my detractors can keep on detracting. I'm as proud of my enemies as I am of my friends, but I will always fight for the Jewish people. I will always fight for women in every single extremist community that exists, not just my community, but any community where women are denigrated and told that they can't. I'm going to make sure that they know that they can.
So now I have to ask, because you just told me about two stories of conversions that you can, you know, put a notch in your belt.
I mean, it's pretty cool.
What is your version of Judaism?
I mean, to me, Judaism
or
is
Jewish life.
Yeah, it's an ethnicity. I don't practice any religious. I don't do Rosh Hashanah. I don't do Yom Kippur. I'm not repenting for something I don't think is a sin. Right? That would be really hypocritical of me. I do the ones my kids want me to do. Like my kids say, hey, let's do Passover. I'll do Passover Julia style, you know? I'll invite a vast array of people. And obviously we're not eating matzah, but we're, you know, gathering together as a family. So to me, the Jewish holidays that we celebrate, it's again, it's about family. It's about unity. It's about community. It's like, you know, if you're an American, if you're an Irish person, you're proud to be Irish, not because you're religious, but because that's your ethnicity. This is my ethnicity. This is part of who I am.
The last question I want to ask you is actually, it started with a quote that I heard you say out loud in a rally for the hostages. You gave a really incredible speech.
Thank you.
And you said, even if we stand alone, we are enough.
Yes.
And you were saying it to an audience of mostly Jewish people, many activists, many famous people there, basically telling them, we don't wait for other people to help.
That's right.
Even if they don't help, we will keep fighting together. And that's a beautiful, beautiful statement, but it, to me, it emphasized something, which is, why are we standing alone? And especially someone like you, who on the one hand has access to many, many other very wealthy business leaders, and on the other hand, many, many people, wealthy or unwealthy, famous models, talents. Why are we so alone when there are so many people out there that could be speaking up? And you know those people, you know, on a person-to-person level.
It's a very complex question. I'm going to give two answers to it because I think they're both very, very important for us to understand. The first one is history, right? You've got the Turks and the Kurds. You've got the Turks and the Armenians. You've got in Rwanda, it's the Tutsi and the what? Yeah.
The Tutsis and the Hutis.
Yes.
We're embarrassing ourselves.
Yes, we are.
But you know what?
Myself,
we're all
you know,
a work in progress.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the Tutsi and the Hutu.
By the way, just so you know, I'm pretty sure there's like someone listening right now and saying like, oh, I can't believe that Julia and Shai doesn't know it. Oh, I can't believe Julia and Shai doesn't know it.
I'm abysmal with names. No, honestly, okay. Names are the bane of my existence.
I'm not going to apologize.
Yeah. I'm just saying, I got engaged and people would say, who are you engaged to? And I'd be like, Yosef. And they'd be like, Yosef who? And I'd be like, I literally don't remember his last name. So names just in general are difficult for me.
Okay.
That's what I said. Tutsi and Hutu. I got it right, baby. Anyway, so historically, there are these very old hates. And they have been going on for thousands of years. And they become part of the weft of society. They are passed down and taught. And if you look at the history of anti-Semitism, think about it. Where is anti-Semitism most prevalent? In Western Europe and in the Middle East, right? I mean, not too many anti-Semites in India, for example. Okay, why? Because Christianity comes around and Jews are very stubborn. We're Am Kisheyoref, right? Everyone else folds. You know, the Christmas tree, for example, do you know where that comes from?
No idea.
So there was a sect of idol worshippers who worshiped the tree. And when the Christians were trying to convince them to become Christians, they're like, it's okay, we'll incorporate the tree. And so that gets incorporated. And so they meld other traditions into Christianity to convince others to come into the fold. But the Jews don't budge. And so they become the enemies of Christ, right? And they get accused of killing Jesus and all of this stuff. And for thousands of years, there's pogroms, murder, forced conversion, all of this stuff because we killed Christ, right? I think it's not until 1982, 84 that the Pope was like, oops, sorry, guys, you didn't actually kill Christ.
Really late very into the 20th century, but the Vatican said, you know what,
we
the Jews are acquitted of deicide.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous.
But now we're
So what ends up happening? So that becomes the anti-Semitism. And the same in the Muslim world, right? Muhammad, in the very beginning of the Quran, if you've read it, right, it's very positive towards Jews. It's towards the end when he realizes they're not converting that it gets pretty nasty and negative. So it starts off as religious hatred because we wouldn't budge. When the Industrial Revolution happens and society opens a little bit more and it's more about science than religion, it just switches shapes. It becomes economic anti-Semitism. And when you think about the fact that historically, all over Europe, Jews weren't allowed to own land. They weren't allowed to farm. What were they supposed to do? They became the innkeepers. They became the bankers because they had no other recourse. They created the middle class because, you know, the entire world was agricultural and they weren't allowed to own land. They weren't allowed to farm. So then it becomes economic anti-Semitism. And it's, oh, the Jews control all the money and the Jews control the world and Protocols of Elders of Zion and Mein Kampf and all this other nonsense and craziness. So we're just evil moneylenders and all this stuff. So religious anti-Semitism transforms into economic anti-Semitism. Then World War II happens and people are like, oh God, this is bad. We fucked up. We got to do something. So it transforms itself into political anti-Semitism. Oh no, I don't hate Jews. I just hate Israel. I just hate Zionists, right? It is the same scourge that has been around since time immemorial. And when a society creates hatred and perpetuates that education and teaching of it, hate's never going to die.
That's the hatred. But do you really believe that most people that are not speaking up for the hostages?
Okay, so that's part two. So part one is the reason we stand alone very frequently is because historically the Western world has hated us for so long. We're just the scapegoats, always. We're always the scapegoats. Social media is a very different question. So I actually, when I came back from Israel, I realized we're fighting two concurrent wars. We're fighting a war on the ground in Gaza with Lebanon and all of that. We're also fighting for the hearts and minds of humanity. Why aren't people speaking up for us? And I couldn't comprehend it. And then I thought to myself, okay, if I'm saying that we're fighting a war on social media, then I have to look at it as an actual theater of war. Okay. On a very basic kindergarten level, as a nation, when you fight a war, what do you need? Simple.
You need soldiers, you need weapons.
Well, you need an army. Yeah. Right? And an army, exactly as you said, is comprised of soldiers and weapons. However, why did Napoleon lose in Russia? They froze to death. They had no coats. They had more soldiers, highly advanced weaponry in that time. They didn't have coats. The third part of what comprises an army is the support system. It's the food, it's the coats, it's the beds, etc. But the core fundamental part of that is the no man left behind philosophy. You know, if you've read anything about World War I or World War II, there's a show called Band of Brothers, right? Because what did they write? In the end, you're not fighting for your country. You're not fighting for an ideal. You're fighting for your brother next to you in the foxhole. That's an army. There's a unit in Israel that Fauda is based on, right?
Yeah.
Where they go behind enemy lines, and if they get caught, they're on their own. If I'm not mistaken, it's under 50 people. And they don't last very long because we as humans need to feel part of a unit, and we need to know that if we do acts of sacrifice and bravery, that our unit will come to our rescue. When I was in Gaza, I worked with an active unit and we got shot at. And two soldiers, a couple hundred feet away from us, literally dropped to the floor. And if I don't even think it was 10 seconds. Within 10 seconds, helicopters surrounded us. Someone came out with a stretcher. I mean, I've never felt safer in my life, ever, because my unit came to the rescue. And that's what makes an army. Okay, now let's extrapolate that into social media. We have the soldiers, people like you and me, who are out there fighting for the Jewish people. We have the weapons. Those are the stories, the testimony, the facts, the hostages, all of this that we should be winning and capturing the hearts and mind of people, because it's insane. However, what happens when Noah from Stranger Things says Zionism is sexy and 500,000 people drop him and try to get Netflix to cancel the show? What happens when Julianne Margulies says, I stand with the Jewish people, and Apple throws her out of the morning show, which she was in? She's behind enemy lines and no one's coming to her rescue. And that's the problem. The problem is we are all based predominantly on self-interest. And if you recognize the fact that today's currency is not money, it's followers. If you're in entertainment, if you're in sports, if you're in the media, your currency is followers. The more followers you have, the more power you have, the more jobs you'll get, the more opportunities you'll have to literally better your life in every imaginable way. But today, if you stand up for the Jewish people, you're going to lose. You're going to lose followers. You're going to lose power. You're going to get attacked. And nobody's going to come to your rescue. And that's the problem. So I came up with a solution, by the way. So that
I was going to ask you.
Obviously, I have a solution.
You know, none of us in the room are breathing right now, and we need like a relief.
Yes. Okay. So here's my solution. It's incredibly simple. If we can actually unify together, you know that joke, right? There's in my community, there's this joke told that a guy gets stranded on a desert island. And he's there for years, and you know the story? He's there for years and years, and finally a ship comes to rescue him, and he says, before I leave, do you want me to show you what I created here? And they walk along, and he sees this beautiful structure. And they say to the guy, what is this? And he said, oh, it's my synagogue. They walk along a little further, and he's like, another beautiful structure, what is this? He's like, oh, that's also a synagogue. So they're like, I don't get it. You're one person on the island. What do you need two synagogues for? He says, oh, that's the one I don't go to, right? There's a lot of divisiveness, right? The fact that I'm such an activist for the Jewish people and I still get attacked and people don't want to hear from me is ridiculous. To me, it's like when there's a fire in your house, you don't say, I only want to use Evian water. Thank you so much. You take whatever water is available, period. You can yell at me later. Right now, we got to get together and fight this thing. So I came up with an idea. Okay, here's my plan. I started a company called Omnation, and I spell it A-H-M because otherwise everyone's going to say Amnation. And the idea is ridiculously simple. You sign up to this website, email. So let's just one second. Let me pull back for a second. Let's take Israel because it's the size of New Jersey. There's close to 8 million people in Israel. There are 4.6 million social media users. And the predominant amount of those people are not very wealthy, are not very famous, and they're sitting at home saying to themselves, how can I help the Jewish people? What can I do? Well, what if out of that 4.5 million, 1 million people sign up, 1 million people in America, they sign up, you give your email, or if you want to do it through Telegram, you can do it in any which way you want. Every morning, what's the first thing you do when you wake up?
What I do, most people do is look at their cell phone. I try not to, yes. If you're listening, don't look at your cell phone when you wake up. Give your mind some, you know, time to breathe, but yeah.
Every morning you get up, you turn on your cell phone. Imagine if every morning there's a push notification and you press a button and you follow three people every single morning. And think about this for a second. So this website, we put up social media users who are fighting on behalf of the Jewish people and getting attacked, okay? Shai, your name goes up there. You've been getting attacked nonstop. Your name goes up there. You wake up the next morning with 2 million new followers. It's game over. Completely game over. The next time someone gets attacked, I don't know, let's think of an actor who's very pro-Jewish, who's not actually Jewish.
Patricia Heaton.
Okay. Patricia gets attacked. She loses 200,000 followers. We put her name on the website. She wakes up the next morning with 2 million followers. Mm. I have a show that is top 10 in 192 countries, and I have 500,000 followers. To gift someone 2 million, 3 million followers, it's a game changer. It's a life changing.
So is this website already live?
It's live. We're trying to get
Nation. AHM Nation.
AHMNation.com. And if we can build critical mass, if we can get people to sign up, we change the trajectory of social media. We're the coats. We're the support. And I know this works for three reasons. A, because I got this idea from a movie called Dumb Money. Mm-hmm. You know, the story of GameStop and Robin Hood, right? All these people who had $5, $10 aggregate together and basically topple the financial system. Aggregation has tremendous power. You can't shadow ban a follow. You can't do anything to it. And these are real people. These are not bots. These are actual human beings. So three things are going to happen. Number one, those people like us who've been fighting in the front lines on our own, we get support. Secondly, all of those people who stay silent because they're too afraid to speak out, because they don't want to damage their reputation, their business, their livelihood. Now, it's in their best interest to help. And so they'll start speaking. I have a person who I represent, very, very famous person, and she heard me talking about Omnation, and she literally came over to me and said, Julia, when it's up, let me know. I'll start posting.
You see, I love that idea. It's a pragmatic idea. It focuses on changing.
But people are not going... people do not operate against their own self-interest, and nobody wants to be behind enemy lines on their own. If you don't have a unit that's going to come to your rescue, you are going to be weaker, more afraid, and much less brave. It's just
I completely get that.
And that's how we change
that.
This, really simply.
And it's still, I want people to speak up because there is a clear moral reason to do so.
Human nature does not allow for that.
You do.
Well, there's always the crazy ones, right?
Do.
Right. But those are...
Everybody who's come on my show...
Are the Fauda people, the people who can go behind enemy lines on their own. You know, most people... can't do that. It's terrifying to them. They don't want to be attacked and not have anyone come to the rescue. Human nature is
a fair point.
I mean, that's the reality. You cannot ever ignore human nature. Any society or structure that ignores human nature is doomed to fail. That's why communism didn't work. That's why, you know, Winston Churchill says, capitalism is the uneven spreading of blessing. Socialism is the even spreading of misery. Because if you work... and it doesn't benefit you, why would you work? It just doesn't work. You cannot ignore the fact that people operate in self-interest. So let's help them. Let's support them. Let's be their unit that comes to their rescue so that they can speak up, so that they can find their voice, so that they can be brave. Because most people will not be brave if there's not someone coming to their rescue. Come on, it's genius.
It is pretty brilliant.
Yeah.
And how many users do you have so far?
I don't know today's count. I think maybe 10, 15, I'm not sure. Somewhere around 10, 15,000. I mean, we need
so you're building
a million, you know? And we need people to be okay with the fact that just because I had the idea and you don't like me, that's okay. You can yell at me later. Right now, our house is on fire. Yeah. Unify. Then we could argue about which synagogue to go to.
I like that. So Omnation, AHMNation.com.
Yes.
People
sign up, please.
Sign up. And
cost nothing. You do nothing.
Even have to follow everyone, right?
No. You look every morning and you press a button. And in 1 second, you change the trajectory of social media. You change the trajectory of what people are hearing. Because the third part that I haven't said yet is that all these, you know... ignorant teeny boppers who listen to what they see on TikTok and, you know, Instagram. If all these people who they follow all of a sudden wake up and are like, you know, it's kind of bad to hate Jews. What do you think is going to happen? It's going to permeate into every fiber of society with one simple thing. We need the coats.
Yeah. I love it. It's brilliant.
Thank you.
Julia, I end every episode with what I've been calling the Jewish lightning round.
Go for it.
A series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer. Just the first thing that comes to mind. You get one pass.
Go.
And I get to decide whether you get the pass. Julia Hart, what is one thing people don't know about you?
That I'm kind of shy as an actual personal person.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
One thing? How about like a million things? We are always at the forefront of every civil rights fight. I mean, who marched with the black people and the civil rights in America? Jews did. Which lawyers went into the South and put their lives on the line? Jews did. If people actually knew the accomplishments and how much good Jewish people have accomplished, they would be standing with us instead of against us.
So what is your favorite curse?
Curse? I don't believe in curses or hate. That's just negative zapping of energy.
Do you feel angry? You feel frustrated? How do you air it?
Meditate. I don't believe in negative emotions. I'm working so hard on myself to eradicate all of them from my body. So when I feel myself getting, sit down, meditate, remind myself, and feel much better.
I'm going to keep going with the rapid fire, but I just have to say, you just told me to never ignore human nature.
But I don't think that's human nature. I think that's what we've been trained to do. I don't think it's human nature.
I see. Okay.
I really believe that inherently we're good. And I believe that we've been taught that we can control our hands and our feet and our legs. And we've been told, but you can't control how you think. You can't control how you feel. That's just patently inaccurate. You can control how you think. You can control how you feel. And I think, you know, look at our superheroes. Our superheroes are people who are capable of withstanding enormous pain. Those are the people we admire and adulate. What if we admired and adulated people who had a capacity for enormous joy, enormous love? I don't think fear and hate and anger are human conditions. I think we've been conditioned to feel that way.
Well, this, I don't know how this question might hit now, but when was the last time you cried?
Oh, I cry all the time. probably yesterday. Yeah, I have I'm a mom, I have insane empathy. And so when I see something on the television of someone suffering, I bawl like a baby.
If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
That's a tough one. Probably Cleopatra.
Cleopatra? Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, of course, the way she's written, she's, this seductress and blah, 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 blah. Have you ever seen an actual photo of what she looks like?
Not a very
attractive woman. The reality is she was one of the most brilliant, well-read, and extraordinary leaders ever. She spoke, dozens of languages. The biggest library in the world was in Alexandria when she was queen. The biggest university was in Alexandria as well, and it was run by Hypatia, right? Another woman. So this is a woman who ruled in a world of men and literally lived her life to create education and equality in a time when those words didn't even exist, really. She was a total badass. Mm-hmm. I'd love to meet her.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Hanukkah.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur.
When do you feel safest?
I don't think I've ever felt safe, to be honest. I'll let you know.
When do you feel least safe?
To me, my life has taken so many iterations that you know, the rug has been pulled out under me so many times that I think it isn't a when, it's something I have to inculcate in myself.
What gives you hope?
I really believe in people. I love humanity. I really do. I know that sounds so fucking stupid, but I think that we are entering, I know this is going to sound a little whack, we're entering a new phase in human evolution with quantum physics, with organoid intelligence, with our ability to measure things that we could never measure before. We're learning so much about what we're actually capable of doing, right? Now they're talking about cerebral spinal fluid and how it could, moving it up, can do all sorts of incredible things to you. The pineal gland can secrete things other than serotonin. I mean, there's just wild, you know, information happening all around us. And I dream of a day when we're not Christians or Muslims or Jews, when we're citizens of the universe and the only religion we follow is love and kindness and connection. And I really believe with all my heart that that's coming. I do.
So until that day comes, what is the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the words Jewish civil rights?
What comes to mind, to me, it's all civil rights. It's you should have the right to live your life safely, autonomously, with pride and a feeling of self-worth.
And finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want listeners to donate to this week?
I would say Magen Adom.
Magen David Adom?
Yeah. I mean, I've been there. What they're doing, you know that there's a part of Magen David Adom that women contribute and donate their breast milk so that young babies of soldiers who are out in the war are fed. I mean, I've never seen anything so beautiful in my life. Every time I think about it, it makes me cry. It's extraordinary.
Magen David Adom, the Jewish response to the Red Cross. Julia, where can people find you?
Julia Hart on social media.
Hart is H-A-A-R-T.
Correct. So at Julia Hart on social media, on the Netflix show, My Unorthodox Life. My book is called Brazen. It's sold everywhere. I also did my own audio, so if you want to hear me tell my story. My new shapewear brand, which is bodybyjuliahart.com.
Well, I have to say, preparing for this was one of the hardest episodes to prepare for, because I was trying to track your life from Moscow, Austin, Monsey, New Jersey, ultra-Orthodox, to the head of a multi-million dollar media
conglomerate,
like, and all I could, and I wrote it to myself just to kind of like a tag for the show, Julia Hart, a woman in movement.
Ooh, I love that.
Because you're always moving and you are a movement.
Thank you.
Even when you came into our studio, you were moving. So I just want to thank you for taking the time. I know you're very busy, for coming and sitting with me. And I'm just glad to say, here I am with Julia Hart.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Really, I have so much respect for you. You can't imagine. I truly, truly admire you.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."